You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Yesterday marked the 58th anniversary of the U.S.'s dropping of the world's first atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. The weapon killed approximately 100,000 civilians within an instant, and in the 5 years following the blast, perhaps as many as another 100,000 died from the slow and debilitating effects of radiation sickness and cancer. Speaking yesterday morning at a solemn ceremony at Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park, Mayor Tadashoki Akiba offered harsh criticism towards the U.S.'s plan to strengthen its nuclear arsenal. He said the United States worshipped nuclear weapons as, quote, God, unquote, and he blamed it for jeopardizing the global nuclear nonproliferation regime. During the ceremony, officials added some 5,000 names to the registry of victims who died immediately or from the after effects of radiation exposure and the bombing, bringing the total accounting to 231,920. 3 days later, on August 9, 1945, another nuclear bomb was dropped on the city of Nagasaki, killing another estimated 74,000 people. The bombs ended the war in the Pacific, but many peace advocates remember them as one of the darkest eras of human history. Survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have spent the past half century sharing their stories with the world, pleading that future citizens of the planet never again allow such a tragedy to occur. Several of these survivors gathered here in the nation's capital earlier this week in a commemoration sponsored by the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area. Among them was Masasaku Saito, a 79-year-old survivor of Hiroshima who was serving in the Japanese Army 10 kilometers from Ground Zero when the bomb was dropped. Saito tells his story through an interpreter.
I was 21 years old when I saw the Enola Gay drop the A-bomb on Hiroshima, causing my entire body to suffer from its effects. A white parachute dropped out of these three planes that attacked that day. The parachute opened up and the bomb exploded 580 meters above ground, turning everything into a sea of fire. Standing near a window, my head, face, and the upper part of my back were burnt. The skin on both sides of my back peeled off and hung limply from my body. Shards of glass were embedded all over my body. A piece of wood was lodged in my neck, and my foot was split open and hemorrhaged a large amount of blood. The two-floor soldiers' barracks I was in collapsed, pinning me underneath and breaking 5 ribs on the right side of my body. Because I was covered in blood and had lost consciousness, I was placed on a crematorium of dead bodies. On the verge of being cremated, I somehow uttered a few words and was saved from cremation. Fifty-eight years later, I still have shards of glass embedded in my body and experience numbness all over. Whenever there is a change in weather or air pressure, like a change from sun to rain or the vice versa, I experience persistent nausea, headaches, and discomfort. In the period right after the atomic bombing, there were a lot of people whose white blood count fell from around 7,000 to 450 and who subsequently died due to infection from their burns. Their cells were destroyed by radiation from plutonium and strontium, and their flesh simply deteriorated. They looked like ghosts with holes opening up all over their face. There were those whose internal organs shut down and who died vomiting blood. There was a severe shortage of doctors, nurses, and medication. Self-administered blood transfusions seemed to be the most effective thing people did. In the first 10 years following the end of the war, there were many A-bomb survivors who, in the absence of any effective treatment, died miserable, lonely deaths while inexplicably being treated like pariahs by their own family members. Perpetually unable to find work, get married, or achieve success at school, A-bomb survivors were forced into extremely wretched lives. Without troubles at work, marriage, and school, and our difficulty in even performing simple manual tasks, I came to see how necessary it is for us A-bomb survivors to assist each other. I ran a student dormitory for A-bomb survivor children, many of whom were forced out of their facilities for fear that they carry contagious diseases. In Iwate Prefecture, five former Red Cross nurses carried out a registration of A-bomb survivors in the year 2000, 55 years after the last such registration. There are still some survivors remaining, and we continue to try to eliminate discrimination against us. I'm convinced of the intricate linkage between cause and effect, between nuclear disarmament and our ability to prevent the reoccurrence of the horrible suffering of the A-bomb. I'm convinced that relief efforts for A-bomb survivors and nuclear disarmament are totally inseparable. And I am absolutely convinced that our single most important mission is to pass down to the next generation a peaceful, healthy earth free from war and nuclear weapons.
No more Hiroshima! No more Hibakusha!
Masakazu Saito, a 79-year-old survivor of Hiroshima, speaking earlier this week at a solemn commemoration of the Hiroshima bombing. The event took place in front of the Lincoln Memorial here in Washington, D.C., thanks to Reem Kathuda of Pacifica Station WPFW for preparing that segment. Throughout the rest of this week here on Peace Watch, we'll continue to listen to the stories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, and we'll reflect further on the meaning of living life in the shadow of the bomb. In the rest of today's program, we'll listen to a speech by Dr. Helen Caldicott, founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility and the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Caldicott, who's been an active campaigner against nuclear weapons, delivered this speech at Claremont College in Southern California in 1988.
What I plan to do first is to briefly outline the medical implications of the nuclear age. And I'm speaking to you as a pediatrician caring about your future. And instead of talking about AIDS and how you can catch AIDS and you have to wear condoms, et cetera, and prevention of AIDS, I'm now going to talk about prevention of a worse epidemic than AIDS. And we start at the beginning of the nuclear fuel cycle, which is mining uranium. You know about uranium, it's a natural radioactive product in the Earth's crust. Now, when you dig out uranium from the ground, as uranium decays, it's got a long half-life. The half-life is the time it takes for half the radiation in that material to decay. I can't remember the half-life of uranium, but it's in the tens of thousands of years. And as I speak, remember that uranium is first really mined to make weapons. Okay, now what happens when you mine uranium? Well, you take it out of the ground, you ship it off to other countries, or here, you put it in nuclear power plants. 100 tons of uranium packed in a nuclear reactor. It reaches what's called critical mass. It doesn't explode like a bomb, but it fissions, and neutrons are given off, which split the atoms of uranium apart in a spontaneous, random way, and 200 new radioactive isotopes are produced, all of which are man-made. Never existed before. Man fissioned the atom, all of which are much more dangerous than uranium. So when you fission uranium, the effect of the radiation is magnified millions of times. Well, why do you do it? Well, we do it to turn on the lights. What do nuclear power plants do? As the uranium fissions, it boils the water in which they're immersed. And the water makes steam, and the steam turns a turbine, which generates electricity, so we can turn our lights on. It's a very, very dangerous way to boil water. Period. That's all it is. But the reason they used nuclear reactors to make electricity was the physicists were smitten with guilt. So they thought they could repair their guilt by building nuclear reactors which would generate electricity and make life more comfortable. But at that time, the data from Hiroshima and Nagasaki weren't really in. And so we learned gradually what radiation does because of the long incubation time it takes for people to develop cancer. The incubation time for AIDS is 2 to 5 years, once exposed to the virus. For cancer, it's any time from 5 to 60 years. In fact, in Hiroshima, the survivors from the bomb are still getting cancer in higher incidences than ever before. So we haven't learned all we have to know about radiation. And when you get your cancer, it doesn't have a little flag on it saying, I was made by some strontium-90, you ate in a piece of cheese that was made in Pennsylvania just after Three Mile Island 10 years ago. so it doesn't identify its origin. So it's hard unless you take a totally exposed group like the Hiroshima victims and compare them to a non-exposed group and do a trial survey, and you have to follow all the people up until they die and then do autopsies on all of them and compare both groups to understand the epidemiology and statistics. You with me? And it's difficult to do. The governments don't like to pay for it because if they find out nasty things, they have to pay reparation to people. Furthermore, they have to admit that radiation causes cancer. If they do that, whenever there's a nuclear spill, like there is in this country many weeks, and the nuclear industry says, don't worry, it's perfectly safe, they're lying. But they don't want to have to really tell you the truth because that means they'll have to pay money to you and, you know. But really, it's legalized murder. Let me explain to you just some of the elements that are made in reactors. Every year they remove one third of the spent fuel rods because they're so contaminated with the isotopes that were made, they're not efficient anymore for fissioning and making energy. One spent fuel rod is 12 feet long and half an inch thick. It's so radioactive, gives off so much gamma radiation, if you stand next to it for a couple of seconds, you'll get a lethal dose of radiation. Now, what does that mean? Remember the people, those brave firemen that went into Chernobyl when it's burning and they tried to stop it burning? How they died? Do you remember the pictures on television? They went bald, that's called alopecia. And they went very pale because they were anemic. And they died like AIDS patients die, vomiting, bleeding to death and dying of massive septicemia because their white blood cells that protect their immune system or that are their immune system were killed. And they die in 2 weeks. That's how you die from acute radiation sickness. If, say, Indian Point melted down 14 miles or so from the centre of Manhattan, you would have hundreds of thousands of people, probably, proper meltdown, dying of acute radiation sickness. That would close down nuclear power overnight. You'd have to have an evacuation plan for the whole of the United States. That's a lesson from Chernobyl, because the wind changed and it blew the stuff all over Europe and all over the Soviet Union. Because you can't predict the way the wind's going to blow. You'd have to have an evacuation plan for 250 million people. And when the NRC was asked, do you have an evacuation plan for a full-scale meltdown? They said no, because that's impossible. Okay? And the chances of a meltdown bigger than Chernobyl occurring in this country in the next 10 or 20 years are greater than 50%. Know that, and know where your nearest nuclear-friendly reactor is. They're all over the country. They have terrible problems. And they remove one-third of the spent fuel rods every year, and they store them in what are called euphemistically swimming pools beside the reactor, because if they're not continually cooled, they themselves will melt down and release the radiation into the air, like Chernobyl. Well, the swimming pools are getting chock-a-block full of rods because they don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. And it's a bit worrying because if they put too many rods in, they could reach critical mass themselves and there'd be a meltdown in the pool because it's reached critical mass. Well, now, they tend to take the rods, especially from military reactors that are built to make plutonium for weapons. They take them to a reprocessing plant, melt the rods in concentrated nitric acid, and from this highly radioactive, highly corrosive, highly thermally hot solution, they remove plutonium, which is what you make bombs out of. And this material taken from the reactor, the 200 isotopes, is called nuclear waste. It's nuclear garbage, and it lasts for hundreds of thousands of years, and no one knows where to put it. Because we have to put it somewhere on the Earth. We can't shoot it off into space because it's too expensive and too dangerous, because the rocket might break up, like the Shuttle or the Delta rocket or the Trident rocket or whatever they test now that fails. So they can't do that. Where do you put it? There might be another ice age. There might be volcanoes. There might be earthquakes. All sorts of things can happen. And the containers leak and melt and the stuff enters the ecosphere. I want to describe just four isotopes, but remember there are 200, most of which have not been studied from a biological perspective to see where they go in the food chain, where they locate in the human body, and how carcinogenic they are, although one can extrapolate about their carcinogenicity from the sort of radiation they give up. One is strontium-90. Now, do you know what? You should not graduate from school without having had a basic education in the history of the nuclear age. I'm telling you as a doctor. It's like washing your hands when you go to the bathroom. You were taught that when you were infants. You should not be graduating from high school without knowing this, because I'm talking about your future. And you know I am. And somehow the adults have failed you by not teaching you this information. Now, strontium-90 is a material made in a reactor. It's got a half-life of 28 years that lasts for 600 years. It's a calcium analog. The body thinks it's calcium, okay? So what happens? You blow up a bomb or Chernobyl melts down. It blows all over Europe. It falls down in hot spots with the rain. And it gets taken, lands on the soil, and it gets sucked up like a sponge by the roots of the grass. The cows come and eat the grass, and then it concentrates by orders of magnitude in the grass, and then further orders of magnitude in the cattle, in the milk. So we drink the milk. We can't taste it. We don't say, I can taste the strontium-90 in this milk. We evolved so our senses cannot detect internal emitters and radioactive material. They're invisible and tasteless. Scary. Scary. So you drink the strontium-90 in the milk, and then you've got to know that babies are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults because their cells are actively mitosing. You can see a baby grow literally before your eyes. And as cells divide, so the genes are replicating and very sensitive to being damaged, the DNA molecule, by the radiation. And so it concentrates the strontium-90 most highly in human breast milk. It's what babies drink. So the baby drinks the milk with strontium-90 and it goes to its bones because the bones are growing. So years later, 10, 20, 30 years later, that person may develop a bone cancer like Teddy Kennedy's son did. He had his leg amputated. Very dangerous form of cancer. Or leukemia, because the white blood cells are made in the bone marrow. Leukemia is cancer of the white blood cells. It means white blood. The next one is cesium-137. It's a potassium analog. Our cells are rich in potassium. In other words, the body thinks it's potassium. Concentrates by orders of magnitude in the grass and then in the meat of the cows and the sheep. And then it concentrates further in our bodies. It induces sarcomas of the muscle. Very, very malignant tumors. It has a half-life of 30 years, dangerous for 600 years. Now the next one is radioactive iodine, I-131. Has a half-life of only 8 days, lasts for 6 weeks. A lot of that was released from Three Mile Island. Do you know that Hershey's Chocolates is 13 miles as the crow flies from Three Mile Island? They rent or own most of the dairies in that area, a very rich dairying industry. Strontium-90 almost certainly came out of that reactor. I don't eat Hershey's Chocolates anymore. Neither should you. I'm serious. Strontium-90 lasts for 600 years. So radioactive iodine got out, it lasts only for 6 weeks, and they did destroy most of the milk. But the trouble is, strontium concentrates in the milk too, you see. So although the radioactive iodine may have decayed, the strontium's still there. And other elements too, apart from the strontium. Radioactive iodine concentrates in the thyroid gland, concentrates very highly in the milk, in the cattle, and then the breast milk, and then the babies, and in the thyroid gland at the base of the neck. It's the only gland that uses iodine in the body. And years later, the child could develop a lump in the thyroid, which is a benign or malignant tumour. Then the next one, and last but not least, I'll describe, is plutonium, named after Pluto, the god of Hades. It is so carcinogenic, it's an alpha emitter, that if you could take 1 pound and put, hypothetically, a piece in every person's lung on Earth, 1 pound is enough to kill every person on Earth with cancer. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of it a year. It has a half-life of 24,400 years. It lasts for 500,000 years. In other words, if I die of a cancer induced by plutonium and I'm cremated, my smoke goes out the chimney and you can breathe it in. You're cremated, your smoke goes out the chimney and you can breathe it in. In other words, it lasts forever. The body thinks it's iron. It's incorporated in the hemoglobin molecule, stored in the liver where it induces liver cancer in dogs and presumably humans. In the bone where it causes bone cancer or leukemia. It crosses the placenta into the developing embryo where in the first 3 months of intrauterine life, the embryo forms all the organs. In the next 6 months, it just grows in size. So plutonium lodges in the head where it kills the cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the right arm. Remember the babies that were born from mothers who took thalidomide for morning sickness, and they were born with just their hands sticking out of their shoulders, gross deformities. We've got a bumper sticker in Australia that says plutonium is thalidomide forever because it can live on to do it to fetus after fetus for the rest of time, not just human fetuses, but animals also, because they also have fetuses. Last but not least, it concentrates in the testicles, in the basement membrane next to the cells that form the sperm, where it's going to induce genetic mutations which will affect future generations for the rest of time. Every male in the Northern Hemisphere already has a tiny amount of plutonium in their testicles from the fallout from the tests in the atmosphere conducted by Russia and America in the 50s and 60s. What that means genetically, God only knows for the rest of time. It takes 20 generations for recessive genes to express themselves. Dominant is the next generation. So we're talking about massive quantities. There are 250 tons of plutonium in the weapons now on Earth and 250 tons in the nuclear waste. And we talk about storing radioactive waste. Where are we going to put it? What signs are we going to put up above the storage? I mean, we didn't speak English when Jesus lived 2,000 years ago, and we're talking about 500,000 years. Will they recognize skull and crossbones even 500 years from now, let alone 5,000 years from now? And as the material leaks, for instance, in Hanford, Washington, there's a thing called a tank farm. What a terrible use of the word farm, which is supposed to grow things for the benefit of biology and us and animals. The farm is full of tanks, 100,000 gallons, containing liquid radioactive waste from reprocessing to get the plutonium for the weapons. And the tanks leak. Most of them are leaking. There are lots of tanks up there. It's just next to the Columbia River. One of the tanks, the indicator indicating the level of the top of the liquid, had ceased to work, and they wondered why, so they looked, and the tank was actually empty. Several of them are empty, draining into the Columbia River. The salmon spawn in the Columbia River. They concentrate the radioactive iodine and isotopes thousands of times. They swim into the Pacific Ocean. We can catch one of those salmon in Australia. In other words, that's the way the material becomes ubiquitous, spreads into the aquifers, gets into the food all over the country, all over the world. And you can imagine our descendants waking up in the morning, the kids already being born deformed, the children already getting leukemia and cancer at young ages. And the food's radioactive. And what have we done? And they say, we've read the history books. And people in the 1980s and the 1960s, they had to have nuclear power to turn their lights on. We didn't inherit the earth from our ancestors. We borrowed it from our descendants. And the knowledge is in. We know all about this now, and we're still doing nothing about it. Now let's move to nuclear weapons. That's why nuclear reactors were designed. In the 60s, Robert McNamara, who is Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, said, if America had 200 hydrogen bombs, that was enough to kill one-third of the Russians, and that was an adequate deterrence. I mean, having the capacity to kill nearly 100 million people. Now, that rolls off my tongue. You're used to hearing data like that, but you think about what I just said. Having the capacity to kill, if necessary, 100 million people. What do the Ten Commandments say? Thou shalt not kill. That policy was enunciated by this Judaic Christian country some 20 years after Hitler died. What did Einstein say? The splitting of the atom changed everything, save man's mode of thinking. You see, they thought about war the way they thought about the Second World War, but they didn't realize that everything had changed. Thus, we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. 1 in 10 Californians work building weapons of mass destruction. 1 in 10, there are more people building weapons here to blow up the planet than there are farmers growing food. In Los Angeles County, 1 in 2 are working building weapons. That ain't any good. It's like, you know, well, they say, we've got to go have jobs. I'm sure the people who built the gas ovens in Germany said the same thing. Got to have jobs. I mean, if we kill 6 million Jews, that's just too bad. Got to have the jobs. Get the morality? There isn't any morality. But more than that, there's a responsibility involved in this, which we've got to get right in our guts and our hearts. Okay, so today, instead of having 200 bombs, we've got about 35,000. I want you to know that Russia has about 25,000 nuclear weapons now. In total, there are about 60,000 on Earth. What does that mean? It's the equivalent of more than 12 tons of TNT for every human being on Earth. It can overkill us many times. Like, we can overkill the Russians 40 times. That means you kill them, they stand up again. They say, where are the bombs? You kill them, they stand up again. Overkill, another euphemistic term that hides the true reality of what I'm talking about. Everything in your country is targeted. All towns of any significance, all cities, all nuclear reactors. A large bomb dropping on a large reactor contaminates an area the size of West Germany, but probably more depending upon the wind direction. Even railroad crossings are targeted with such a redundancy of weapons. There are only 240 major cities in the Northern Hemisphere. There are 240 bombs on a Trident submarine, enough to destroy every major city. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times today. Right in the front section of the business pages. If you want to learn what's going on in this country, read your business pages. And it's got pictures of the most awful, god-awful weapons of death here. Great big planes and missiles that look like you know what. And then it says who's making the most. And who's at the top of the list now making the most money? McDonnell Douglas, number one. General Dynamics, number two. General Electric, number three. There's a boycott on General Electric. People are not buying their products anymore. They make things that are good for life and good for the global gas oven. They are one of the biggest nuclear weapons makers in the country. Lockheed, General Motors, Raytheon, all your friendly corporations, Martin Marietta, United Technologies, Boeing, Grumman, Rockwell, Tenarco, Honeywell, Litton, IBM, Westinghouse, GT, Textron, LTV, Northrop, Texas Instruments, TRW, IT&T, Allied Signal, AT&T. Who's got shares in those companies? You needn't put your hands up. Get rid of them, because you're paying for the annihilation of the planet. You can't do it anymore. Life is not about money. Life is about living. It's about music and laughing and intimate relationships and fighting with your spouse and having babies and watch your children grow up and helping them live. It's only appropriate that we work together, for if we do not, the present situation in the world will destroy the planet. What I'm really saying to you is that this is urgent. This isn't say, well, we'll do it in 20 years. This is now. If your kid had leukemia, would you say, well, I won't get any treatment for them till next year? Within a week, you'd know everything there was to know about leukemia. You'd be totally dedicated to your child. You'd never sleep a full night again. If they died, you'd never recover. If you had leukemia, how would it change your life? That's what I'm talking about. Total commitment to your life, your future, and to the earth, if you love this planet. The hope lies in your hearts and your souls and your intelligence and your minds. We've done an awful lot. I think we're 50% there towards survival. But by God, if we don't stand up for ourselves and our kids, we don't stand up for ourselves like now, we're going to lose our planet. Now, I think the time for being polite is over. Education still must go on, but I think now we've got a model in this country which was extremely effective. Who was it? And that's Martin Luther King. We must go and sit at the feet of the civil rights people who are still around and still alive and learn from them their tactics. We must remember Gandhi and what he did. It's time to practice non-violent civil disobedience. We can't be comfortable anymore, because if we continue being comfortable, ultimately we'll be vaporized. You don't always have to say things to please people. Speak the truth. Make people uncomfortable, because only through discomfort will they discover the truth. That's love. And you all are capable of doing that. Do not give away your integrity, your essence, and your soul. There are enough people in this room tonight to save the world.
Dr. Helen Caldicott is the founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility and the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. She spoke at Claremont College in Southern California in 1988. For more info on Caldicott's organization, visit www.nuclearpolicy.org. Oh, and happy birthday, Helen. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Scott Powell and Brian DeShazer of the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.